Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. On May 9th of this year, an extremely radioactive tunnel at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State partially collapsed. The tunnel is part of the Purex facility, which was used to manufacture plutonium for nuclear weapons. The tunnel that collapsed holds rail cars loaded with contaminated discarded equipment, and there are fears that the opening created by the tunnel collapse could leak radiation into the environment. This morning, we talk with Dan Sears, Columbia River Keeper Conservation Director, and Tom Carpenter, Executive Director at Hanford Challenge, about this tunnel collapse in the context of Hanford's long and troubled history of failed cleanup efforts. Dan and Tom, welcome to Locus Focus.
It's great to be here.
Yeah.
Hi, Tom. Well, I was just talking to Dan before we went on the air about like my long and checkered past with Hanford, because I've been I was doing a lot of coverage of Hanford in the early 80s and periodically lapsed back into it. And the thing that's the most disturbing is every time I've done a story about Hanford, it's been about cleanup. Though the first couple were about trying, I would talk to people at Hanford who were just about to fire up the Purex facility. This was back in 1982. And also to activists who were trying to stop the then N reactor, which was this amazing reactor that both bred plutonium but also powered for electricity. So let's talk a little bit about, before we get into this latest catastrophe at Hanford, a little bit of background on what Hanford is, because I think there are still people who don't really even know that this facility is 220 miles upstream from us on the Columbia River. So what is Hanford and why should we be concerned about it? And I'll start with Tom.
Okay, well, Hanford is a facility that was started in World War II to make the first material for atomic bombs, and so that material is called plutonium. And plutonium is a new element for humankind and for the planet. It was created through fissioning, and so scientists leading up to World War II started looking at the potential of using radioactive materials as an energy source and as a bomb material, and figured it out at Los Alamos, and decided to produce it in Washington State. So in southeastern Washington State, around the area that is now known as the Tri-Cities, Richland, Kennewick, and Pasco, this facility was built. It was huge. It took 50,000 workers to living in trailers and bunkhouses and whatnot to put this thing together overnight. And then they managed to build a reactor, the first reactor in the planet, and a reprocessing facility, which is, think of it as a giant filtration plant, to filter out the chemicals in this highly radioactive spent fuel. And they successfully managed to produce and separate enough plutonium to make a bomb. That bomb was exploded in Trinity, New Mexico, and then later used against Japan in Nagasaki. The Hiroshima bomb was a uranium bomb. The Nagasaki bomb was plutonium. Subsequently, the U.S. government decided that plutonium was the material of choice for nuclear weapons and went ahead and expanded Hanford's mission to have 9 reactors, 5 reprocessing facilities, and thousands and thousands of other buildings in service of that mission. And it operated throughout the Cold War to make enough plutonium for, you know, over 50,000 nuclear weapons that the U.S. produced. The result of that was the worst contaminated facility, the biggest environmental mess that we have in the United States. And there's an estimated $7 trillion went into making plutonium and nuclear weapons. The cleanup costs are in the hundreds of billions. So the latest estimate that's out there for the cleanup out at Hanford is in the neighborhood of $150 billion, and for the country approaching $500 billion. And so that's what we've been doing since 1989. That's when the cleanup was kind of announced, that the transition from production of plutonium to cleanup. And unfortunately, the cleanup isn't going so well, and we haven't made a whole lot of progress yet. We have spent a lot of money.
I just want to interject, there's kind of a funny little history about Hanford, that it's one of the few places in the United States where white people were treated like Native Americans. Because I understand that people had like a weekend notice. There was a little town of Hanford, I think a population 300 and something, and everybody was evacuated. And it was like with no, basically time to pack your bags and get out of there. And to me, one of the interesting symbols of that is the Hanford High School, which at least the last time I was out on the reservation, which was a number of years ago, it's still there. It's four walls, no roof, weeds growing around it. And to me, it speaks volumes about the attitude that the U.S. military and Department of Energy subsequently have towards the people of that region. And of course, you can't see the effect right there on the part of Native Americans, but they were really ripped off of a lot of their tribal and treaty legacy as well. So what does it say for the level of contamination? Because we hear this a lot from the tribes about just how they're basically their food and medicines have been just really destroyed along the Hanford Reach now. But what does that say about the attitudes of the Cold War and during World War II about the environment and what you do to a landscape like that?
I mean,
Dan, you want to take that?
Yeah, from my perspective, what's jarring about Hanford is that it continued for decades. It wasn't as if we built a weapon to end World War II, dropped it on Nagasaki, killed all those people, and then it stopped. You know, it went on and on and on. And to maintain that, you know, sort of dispossession of everyone who had a relationship with that site, it was a very aggressive program. People, you know, older than I have a lot more knowledge about what Hanford was like during the production era yourself. I think
I was there at the end of the production era for the first time. Yeah, it was startling. I mean, I remember being really fascinated because I've been reading a lot about Hanford and reading a lot about nuclear waste at the time back in the early 80s, and I really wanted to go and see it for myself. And it was really startling to see what they could do to the landscape. And there's all these little radioactive buttons that are all over the place along the river, and you just know that there's this danger everywhere. In fact, I had been reading this book about novel by John Hockenberry. It was kind of a strange book about Hanford, and mentioned the 200 area, and that was a place that you absolutely didn't want to be in because it's so contaminated. So when I was actually driving out to meet some Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission scientists to study, to look what they were doing along the reach and salmon studies, I got lost, and I was driving around the 200 area. Mm-hmm. And it makes you really wonder how people can allow this kind of stuff to go on. I wonder, particularly, Dan, since your focus on Hanford is from the perspective of the river, what do you see Hanford's role on the river is, and your role as mm-hmm. riverkeeper to try to keep Hanford at bay?
I mean, from our perspective, you know, we sort of plant our heels on the shore of the Columbia River and try to imagine what the contamination is that's beneath our feet, that's reaching the Columbia River. It is, ironically, the best main stem spawning habitat for Chinook salmon in the entire Columbia River system, as far as the main stem spawning habitat. It's because it's undammed.
And it's the only stretch of the Columbia in the United States that's undammed.
That's right. And so it remained undammed and off limits for decades. And for that reason, it's very attractive to salmon and steelhead. In fact, when you float down the Hanford Reach right alongside these reactors, you see all types of wildlife. And particularly, you see a lot of fish in the river. And so from our perspective, Hanford is critically important to the health of the Columbia River as a whole, not just to the people who live right downstream, who pull their drinking water just miles from the Hanford boundary, the Hanford nuclear site boundary, but to people all the way down to Astoria. You know, the Daily Astorian just editorialized that it should be the top priority of the federal government to ensure that no more contamination reaches the Columbia River from Hanford in response to the event on May 9th. It's something that I think what concerns me is for people who are younger, the knowledge of what Hanford is and was is kind of being lost and slipping away. And what we get is these sort of bursts of very alarming information that come out. Things like what happened on May 9th that remind us that we have the most contaminated site in North America right in our midst. So our challenge, I think, is to motivate people throughout the region to maintain a connection to this place that was off limits, that is now, you know, in partial, you know, 195,000 acres of which are a national monument that President Trump has ordered to be reviewed for potentially being removed.
And so he put a dam back in there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's, I think what's really important about keeping the focus on the cleanup and being really honest about what's not going well with cleanup is making sure we don't ever get in the position of thinking that it's a great idea to go back to producing plutonium or, you know, using nuclear technology in this way. It's absolutely a travesty what's happened. There's over 60 square miles of groundwater at the Hanford site that are contaminated above drinking water standards. There's a plume of radioactive iodine-129 with a half-life of 16 million years, that isotope, moving all the way from Purex, just, I think it's within a mile of the Columbia River at this point, not far from the Columbia, so a couple miles. It's the stakes are very, very high for everyone in the region.
Well, what's really alarming to me, I mean, I did my first project in 1982. There was no known plume, radioactive plumes yet. We were talking about the all the contamination, because what we haven't mentioned that during World War II, they were dumping radioactive, low-level radioactive waste into unlined pits and trenches all over the now 200 area of Hanford. And they didn't really start starting to clean that up until, I think, 1989. And so when I was there in 82, they're kind of poo-pooing, oh, it's just low-level waste, it's not bad. And we have the high-level waste in these double-shelled and single-shelled tanks, and we're going to be moving all the high-level waste from the single-shell tanks into the double-shell tanks. So a few years later, they discovered a plume of radiation from Purex facility, which was moving towards the Columbia River. And then there was announcements of all these single shell tanks were leaking, and now the double shell tanks are leaking. And the last time I was out there looking at the tanks, and this was a number of years ago, I was shown the double shell tanks, and I actually had a relatively honest person who was there who was talking about how the lifespan of these tanks was really limited. And shortly after that interview, they started to leak. So everything that environmental activists and conservationists have been concerned about over the last 50, 60, 70 years, I guess now, it's all coming true. So, Tom, in the face of this, how do you go forward to try to, like, make it loud enough that this is such a dangerous place and that something really has to change? Like, they really have to get serious about cleanup.
Well, I mean, Hanford's kind of doing the job for us in a way. We have a staff here that does nothing but outreach, education, advocacy. We bring lawsuits. We communicate with Congress, with the state of Washington, with other organizations like Dan's. And you just have to, keep on top of what they're up to out there. One of the biggest, there are several, categories. One is the very high-risk operations that are happening out there. And these fall in the category of, for instance, the underground nuclear waste tanks, which, as you pointed out, are way beyond their design life. They're crumbling in the ground. A third of them have leaked, maybe more. And, we have 56 million gallons of high-level waste in these tanks. It's two-thirds of the U.S. inventory. I mean, a drop of this stuff is fatal. So, and it will remain so for a long, long time. And yet, we don't have any treatment system in place, despite having spent many, many billions of dollars. A collapse of one of those tanks or more, because, if one collapses, it could lead to others, or an explosion or a fire could release tremendous amounts of, what they call inventories of radioactive materials to the air and water. In the area, and certainly affecting Oregon and Idaho and the state of Washington, and maybe beyond, depending on weather conditions and severity of the accident. That's not the only thing, right? So they've got very large inventories of cesium-137 and strontium-90 and these decrepit pools of water called the B plant and the waste encapsulation storage facility. I'm going to use a number here. And it'll be a little confusing, but it's about 110 million curies of strontium-90 and cesium-137. And we measure those elements in, for permissibility in a water supply. at such a low level that, for instance, strontium 90, the permissible amount of strontium 90 in a liter of water, just, you know, like a pop bottle full of water, is 7 trillionths of a single curie. So it's mind-boggling the amount of radioactive materials they have stored at Hanford, and their containers are rotting in the ground. And, you know, I just mentioned two. There are a bunch of other ones as well. And so staying on top of that, I mean, these tanks produce hydrogen gas, very explosive, very flammable. Even, you know, emptying the tanks is a risk. You know, the tanks leak into the groundwater and go into the river eventually. There are little hot spots along the river, in the reactors, et cetera. So it's a massive, massive undertaking. And unfortunately, the whole situation has just become almost a jobs program for the Tri-Cities. And so Congress, you know, reliably, you know, schedules about $2 billion a year toward cleanup, but they don't understand the risks out there. And then you have something like the T-Rex tunnel, which was a good wake-up call. And it was good because it didn't result in the loss of life or the contamination of people, as far as we know. However, it was severe enough that it got everybody's attention. So you've got this decaying infrastructure, this old facility. It should have been cleaned up by now, but we've kicked the can down the road too many times, and now we're having to pay the piper. So litigation is one. Pressure from the states, both the state of Oregon and the state of Washington, they've brought litigation in the past and are engaged in litigation now. That's what it sometimes takes to get the government's attention. But also, I mean, the most important thing is really public pressure and keeping the pressure up so that more people know what's happening and take some action to address these massive issues over at the Hanford site. And as you point out, not many people know the full details that they need to know to take that action.
If you're just tuning in this morning, we're talking with Tom Carpenter, who we just heard, who's executive director of Hanford Challenge. He's up in Seattle. And we have in the studio with us Dan Sears, who's the Columbia River Keeper Conservation Director. And we're talking about the most recent catastrophe of many at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, which is the collapse of this tunnel at the Purex facility. So what was this tunnel? I understood, actually, I knew very little about this tunnel, even though I'd visited the Purex facility back in the early 80s. What was this tunnel? What was in the tunnel? And what was released when the tunnel collapsed?
I'll let you take that one, Tom.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, this tunnel was built, there are two tunnels actually, right? So one was built in 1956 and operated until 1965. And it was built to basically be a storage place for some of these rail cars that have been used to transport highly radioactive fuel from the reactors to the Purex plant. And Purex's job was to dissolve the radioactive fuel elements in acid and you know, use chemicals to filter out the plutonium, and the rest of it was destined for being dumped out into the desert, for instance, or into waste tanks. And so the tunnel accepted these train cars. And as long as you're putting a radioactive train car in there, then you're going to load it up with other stuff because, you know, they're big empty cars. And so all kinds of materials went into those train cars. Unfortunately, very poor record keeping available for what that was. But what we do know is that the levels of radioactivity inside the tunnels is so high that no human could enter the tunnel. You would get a lethal dose within you know, a minute or less. So they can't get devices into there to really kind of inventory what's there. So the tunnels were known to be temporary. The first tunnel was built with simply Douglas fir timbers. And You know, those don't last. They're subject to corrosion, you know, from the soil, from heat, from radioactivity, from fungus. All those attack wood, of course. And so it was recognized even in 1980 that tunnel number one was at risk. The tunnel number two was built better. It was built in the 60s, and they used steel and concrete for that tunnel, so there's less concern about that. But nonetheless, you know, there has been attention paid to the integrity of Purex Tunnel number one and worry about whether or not it's going to make it. So a second review was done in 1990, I believe, and I might have my dates wrong, but it was around that time, and they said, oh, we should be good until 2004, and then we really probably need to go make sure we get this cleaned up. And that never happened. So here we are in 2017, 2 years ago, some universities did a study of high risks at Hanford. It's called the CRESP Commission, the Consortium on Risk Evaluation, and they identified the Purex Tunnel collapse as a very serious risk that needed to be taken care of. So the Department of Energy and the Hanford Advisory, you know, prodding of the Hanford Advisory Board, which is a citizen commission, saying you better get on this. They did start to, you know, start up a process to investigate it, but as they were looking, this tunnel collapsed. And so that the history of this tunnel is pretty fraught with warnings, number one, and number two, a good deal of ignorance about what is really in there. And finally, number three is if a part of the tunnel collapsed, then you can reasonably expect that the whole thing is subject to collapse. So only 20 feet of that tunnel out of 386 feet has collapsed. And so we're in a very touchy place right now where you could, you know, at any moment see the rest of that tunnel or part of the tunnel collapsing. And the concern is that there'd be a fire or an explosion or some mechanism to that results in a release of material to the air. And that was one of the scenarios that this CRESP committee looked at and identified a pretty severe radioactive dose resulting to co-located workers or anyone who happens to be in the area. And by the way, I'll point out that there was a tour bus, a public tour bus, going through next to Purex that same day when the tunnel collapsed. So, you know, it raises the question of who else is really at risk there. But it was a big wake-up call. This is a very dangerous tunnel, and it's only one of the many, many other areas that have high-risk facilities.
Now, when the tunnel collapsed, there was concern about radiation being released. Was there, I was trying to tell from the photograph I saw of the collapse, was there like an actual hole in the ground where you could look down and see those railroad cars?
Yep. Yeah, sure could. And, you know, Hanford has said, oh, no radiation escaped from the tunnel, and that's actually not accurate. Radiation was coming out of the hole, was beams of radiation, right? So this contamination is particles of radioactive dust, for instance. To anyone's knowledge, little, if any, escape, but there was a high radiation area around the hole. So, you know, they did have a no-fly zone up to, I think it was 4,000 feet above that tunnel opening because of the gamma radiation. That's one of the reasons they filled in the hole pretty quickly, that and also preventing a windstorm from carrying contaminated materials out of that tunnel.
What did they fill the hole with?
So, soil.
Soil?
Some soil in there. Yeah. And now the proposal is to fill the rest of the tunnel with what they call grout, with a low-density concrete-type substance that will help support the tunnel and keep things in place. We have big questions about whether or not that's a good idea because that increases heat, et cetera. So those are questions that are all being looked out before they do it.
Well, my understanding too is with concrete, gamma radiation will penetrate at least a couple feet of concrete. I mean, you have to have really, really thick concrete walls to stop gamma radiation.
Oh yeah, but you know, it is a tunnel in the soil, and no one's really particularly worried about the gamma radiation unless there's a mechanism to release it from its current, you know, situation. And the fact is that we're stuck with Hanford's radioactivity, massive, massive inventory of radioactivity one way or another. It's, you know, some of it will be hopefully immobilized in glass and taken off site into a deep geological repository far below the water table, et cetera. But, you know, frankly, most of Hanford's radioactivity and radioactive materials, at least, are going to be probably at Hanford. And just the quantities are just so large. It would take, you know, tens of thousands of train cars and trucks to remove a portion of Hanford's radioactivity. I mean, you talk about 60 square miles of contaminated water. You know, there are 42 linear miles of trenches, 15 feet deep, 20 feet wide, full of contaminated material. 120 million gallons of high-level waste dumped to the soil. And DC cribs with no plan to clean that up. I mean, you know, really, it's mind-boggling what the problem is, that the problems you have out there. However, you can sequence the high-risk ones and get on top of those, and that's what everyone wants the government to do here, and not lose sight of the fact that there are long-term issues that will threaten future populations and future generations of people and the river that have to be also monitored and taken care of.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Tom Carpenter, who's executive director of Hanford Challenge up in Seattle, and we have in the studio with us Dan Sears, Columbia Riverkeeper Conservation Director. We're talking about the tunnel collapse at the Purex facility at Hanford about 8 weeks ago that is threatening to release massive amounts of radiation that has been buried in these tunnels for up to 70 years. As you're talking, Tom, I keep thinking about all the lines that I've heard from Hanford over the, I mean, I've been covering this story now for 36 years, and I feel like there's been so little movement. You mentioned putting some of the waste in glass, which is the vitrification process. When I was first there at Hanford in 1982, they gave us these little black glass marbles, and there was no radiation in the marbles, but this was an example of what they were going to do with the radioactive waste. And then the vitrification program fell apart, I think, under Reagan. And when I was back there in 2002, they were talking about vitrification again, but they were starting from scratch. And when I was there in 2002 is when I had the most forthcoming, honest tour guide who told me that the tanks were leaking. And he was talking about how every time there's never a new presidential administration, they go back to zero again. So that, I guess, explains why so many decades after this contamination was first laid in the ground that we're still going nowhere. But another concern I have, when I was there in 2002 and I had a whole panel of people who were sitting around a conference table and I was interviewing them all together. And there's this guy from Fluor who was then, I think they're still the chief contractor for cleaning up. And he was telling me how they talked about the unlined pits, trenches, where they dumped all this radiation back in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. And he said, but we no longer are doing that. And he mentioned it like five times, and it really sounded like he said, you know, I've stopped beating my wife. There was something very weird about it. And then I interviewed Jerry Pollitt about 5 years later, and he said, the guy was lying. They didn't stop dumping that waste until, I guess, maybe 10 years ago, if that, even that long ago. So when there's this long history of lying and obfuscation, how do you move forward?
You know, this is a real challenge, I think. And I think the work that Hanford Challenge has done, I should say, is really remarkable, where they brought forth stories from workers who are, you know, in this culture. And I think, for me, one of the things I thought was really interesting right after the Purex tunnel collapse was a letter from the chairman of the Yakima Nation, Jode Gowdy, who sent a letter to the Department of Energy just saying, you know, you told us a couple of years ago that this thing was going to last another 30 years, and you kicked the can down the road, and you said, you know, there would be no problem with this facility for a long time. And now that that's clearly not the case, you know, what now? And that's, I think, what's the way that I think we can pierce the turning over of administrations. I mean, I can't even guess. I would hazard to guess how many heads of the Department of River Protection Tom has met with. You know, the people who are have a long view on this cleanup process are the tribal nations who are very engaged, groups like Hanford Challenge, Riverkeeper, Heart of America Northwest, and to some extent the Oregon Department of Energy, people who have a little bit of independence from it. And it's really challenging when you can't buy the basic line that's being put forth by Department of Energy sometimes.
So where do we go from here? I mean, I was thinking, well, I'll ask you this, Dan, because this is close to your heart. How does this tunnel collapse compare in your mind with the Mosier oil train derailment a year ago in terms of being a wake-up call?
It's, well, I think to parallel what Tom said, no one was injured badly. No one was killed. And so in that sense, it was good to have something that caught the region's attention and focused the attention on these on an issue. These are the two issues that honestly keep us up at night at Riverkeeper, to be really blunt, are the very long-term, but also acute risks at Hanford, and the oil trains barreling down the Columbia River, which just seem like insane Russian roulette every day. I think for me, this was more frightening in some ways because I knew that there were workers so close, and maybe Tom could speak to the ongoing challenge of that workers are having out there with maintaining their safety.
And also, I mean, there have been some major Hanford whistleblowers. Are there people that still have the nerve to really stand up and say what's happening there?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Hanford has done a good job of beating down a lot of people. There have been some successes that we've had and others in bringing lawsuits and getting people either money or their jobs back or whatever. So people are still coming out of the woodwork and challenging the paradigms, basically, and exposing information. And we're here to help them. We have legal staff, expert in these types of law. We have a lot of attorneys that we work with. And if it weren't for the whistleblowers, if it weren't for the employees out there, we wouldn't know a whole lot of things that we know now. One of those areas is in, the worker health and safety issue. A number of people have been exposed to chemical vapors coming out of these tanks. This is an area where it's just this dystopian, kind of situation where people get exposed. Some people get seriously injured, even including neurological disease, brain damage, lung damage, heart conditions from exposure to chemicals coming out of these high-level waste tanks. And there are some nasty, nasty chemicals, very dangerous at extremely low levels, and they can't monitor these chemicals in real time as they come out. So what they do is just deny it. And they've been denying it despite many, many, many expert reports, and it's unconscionable. They're doing it to save money. They're doing it so they don't have to take action, and they are sacrificing their own workforce as they do this. And we're in court with them right now, and so is the Attorney General of the State of Washington, Bob Ferguson, and a union, a brave union out there, is taking a stand. So there are three entities in federal court forcing them to use supplied air and respiratory protection for these workers as they work around these high-level waste tanks. It's not clear that we will win in the long run, but we are going to fight that fight. In the meantime, we just had another set of exposures last week, the week before. So it's that does keep happening. Although outside the tank farms at this point, because everyone inside the tank farms is wearing supplies and respiratory protection. But it's an example of the deception and the lies that you hear You go to the website that the DOE maintains, and you don't see any news of, you know, bad news variety, especially when it comes to the waste tanks or the waste treatment plant, the waste of money. You know, people aren't aware that these Hanford contractors have been pleading guilty to criminal fraud, paying large fines. One company paid $18 million in fine with a guilty plea. They still work out there. They still have the contract. It didn't slow down the government at all. That was 5 years ago at this point. Another set of contractors paid $125 million, Bechtel and AECOM, to settle allegations of fraud against them at the waste treatment plant. They're still working out there too, right? It's just like, it's business as usual. Sometimes it just seems like Hanford is this giant ATM in the desert for corporations to go and withdraw their money. And there's no accountability, there's no consequences for wasting all the money that should be going to the cleanup.
Well, I like the way you throw out nuclear waste and waste of money in the same sentence, which I think is really important. I feel like, Tom, I would really like to continue this conversation, and I think I would like to do a lot more shows on Hanford. I feel like I've gotten sucked back into this fascination and horror that has riveted me with Hanford for many years. So let's talk about doing another show maybe in the fall, and we can do an update on what's happening. How's that sound?
That sounds great.
Okay, so I'll be in touch with you about that, and hopefully by that time you'll get your landline working so we can have a better connection. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Tom. I'm going to stick around with Dan for a few more minutes because we have some good news we're going to talk about for a change.
Excellent. All right.
You can stick around for the good news if you want to, Tom.
Unfortunately, not Hanford related.
Okay, so to the good news, there was a Supreme Court decision, and we're moving now to back to Western Washington, to Vancouver, mm-hmm. Washington, exactly, to a series of meetings that the Port Commission of Vancouver had with Tesoro and Savage that were secret meetings. And people, including Columbia Riverkeeper, several organizations, filed a lawsuit against them. So let's talk about what's happened with that.
Yeah, along with really outstanding attorneys at Smith & Lowney, our clean water attorney, Miles Johnson, and they argued that just plainly that the business of the public for this port commission at the Port of Vancouver should be done in public.
Oh, wait, I forgot to say, this is about the oil terminal.
This is about oil transit. So I was going to try to draw the parallel here, which is government transparency is incredibly important when you're dealing with things like dangerous oil trains or nuclear waste at Hanford. The thread that connects a lot of this and a lot of the work along the Columbia River is making sure that people have access to decision-making and information that makes for a good outcome. And, the Port of Vancouver chose to discuss in secret how they would proceed with an oil terminal. And the Supreme Court agreed with us that, and disagreed with lower courts, that the Port had correctly interpreted Washington's open public meetings law. And so that decision was unanimous. It was very clear and an emphatic decision that said, look, the public's business is to be done in public, particularly when it pertains to such important issues. And we feel vindicated by this. Of course, the Port of Vancouver has not chosen to rescind the lease or withdraw from the project, which seems insane at this point, to be continuing with an oil train project after so much has gone wrong.
But what kind of effect does the Supreme Court decision have on the validity of the lease agreement that was drawn up in a very opaque meeting?
It could provide them with an opportunity to withdraw from the lease. Right now, there are two people on the Port Commission who insist that this is the right project for the Port of Vancouver. And that's very unfortunate. They're very out of step with all of Vancouver. And we think it's likely that the Energy Siting Council in Washington and Governor Inslee will end up making this decision. If they don't, and it's dragging out for a long time, the Port of Vancouver is far past due for doing the right thing and jettisoning this project, letting it go. You asked me, like, what about these two things? The tunnel collapse, the oil train derailment. These are things that can affect the health of the Columbia River and our salmon for generations. We're talking about, in the case of Hanford, millennia, with iodine-129 moving towards the river, or uranium or plutonium or any of these contaminants. oil trains coming into the Columbia River estuary, barreling down and being loaded onto tankers one after another, after another, after another. It's an insult and a huge risk to all of the work to protect salmon. And so oil trains really threaten the estuary where the salmon come in. And in some ways, Hanford threatens the best main stem spawning habitat where they're headed.
Well, on that note, and hopefully we're going to have good news coming out of the Supreme Court decision. We need to end the show. I want to thank Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper very much, and Tom Carpenter, with who's the executive director of Hanford Challenge. Thanks for being on, and we'll be doing this. They'll be doing this show again in a few months. And we've been talking with Dan Sears, Columbia Riverkeeper Conservation Director, and Tom Carpenter, Executive Director of Hanford Challenge. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locustfocus. Next week, we'll hear footage recorded in Mosier. Speaking of the oil train derailment, it was recorded on June 3rd at a rally in March to commemorate the first anniversary of the oil train derailment there. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Jello Biafra. Thanks for listening.
To get the brimstone fire, take warning, my dear brother. Be careful how you land.